you got to be proactive in anything that you do. And I don't know anybody that's been successful that's been passive. Right? The people that are successful, they just do. It was sort of one of those stories where it just took off. We hit our first year's sales targets in 3 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles in 4 weeks, had a wait list of thousands of people. It was wild.
All right, welcome to another episode of Business Untitled, here with my co-stars, Mike Novogratz, Mel Carter. Today, we are super excited to have Neil Blumenthal. He's co-founder and co-CEO of Warby Parker. Warby needs no introduction, I think.
Right here, baby.
Mike's got some Warbys on right now. Amazing direct-to-consumer, disruptive brand in the eyewear, eyeglasses space. I think everybody knows about that. They've been an incredible story over the last 10 years, and we're super excited to have him here. So, Neil, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're in the hot seat today. I would say early on, you got to be nice, because I have promoted Warby Parker on CNBC, on Bloomberg, on this podcast, mostly because I lose glasses all the time.
Yep.
And this was like the economical way to buy a lot of glasses, right?
Yeah.
They're not that cheap, but they're not that expensive. And so like for a guy that loses 10 pairs every 6 months, these are my babies.
Yeah.
Wow, did he just pay you to say that?
He did it.
Our number one champion advocate.
They need no champions. They've kind of revolutionized the direct-to-consumer business.
And nobody loses more pairs of glasses than you.
Literally.
That would be...
he breaks one side and wears it still with one. It's like the craziest thing in the world. Yeah.
And just to kick it off, because I know you may not have watched every episode, and that's okay, but really this came from Mike and Mel and I being really good friends and just wanted to share some of our wisdom with community around entrepreneurism and business and things like that. So we just wrap and love to hear your story. So I guess first we always ask people to just start out for a second and talk about kind of where you grew up, how you got into it, those, you know, kind of founding moments, whatever you want to say.
So I grew up here in New York City, grew up on 8th Street and Mercer. You know, as a young child, I always wanted to start an eyewear business. No, just kidding. I don't know if anybody sort of says that or has that in their path. I grew up around lots of creative people. Growing up in downtown Manhattan, all my sort of friends' parents were either dancers or creatives at ad agencies, or right, it was a certain profile of folks that worked and lived in sort of Greenwich Village, the West Village, and Soho and Tribeca at the time. My parents, my mom was a nurse, my dad was an international tax consultant at PwC, so not like...
He's definitely in the CIA and just didn't tell you guys.
So not necessarily like the most sort of entrepreneurial, I would say, setting, but both my grandparents had started businesses. I actually was most passionate about changing the world and social enterprise, and went to a school called Friends Seminary that was very progressive. This was also in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and was influenced by, we used to, every sort of Christmas, would decorate bags that would then be given to an amazing nonprofit called God's Love We Deliver, that would deliver food to people homebound with AIDS. And it was, these were like formative experiences, again, growing up in New York City at the time, and just like learning to give back. So I actually, when I went to college, I studied international relations. I thought that I was going to go maybe work for the CIA or the State Department. I did some graduate coursework on conflict resolution and international mediation, and thought that if we could get countries to stop killing each other, we could focus on, you know, things like health and education.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a path that I was on. And I met this really dynamic eye doctor named Jordan Casalo, and he had this idea to train low-income women in the developing world to start their own businesses, giving sort of vision tests and selling glasses in their communities, because there's about 1 billion people on the planet that don't have access to glasses, and you realize, like, that's crazy. Like, glasses have been invented 800 years ago. Why are there 1 billion people that don't have access to this product? And a critical one, right? You can't learn in a classroom. You can't be productive and earn a living, right, if you can't see. So I thought that this was a really interesting idea of how do you solve this problem at large scale? 1 billion people need glasses. You can't just give away 1 billion glasses a year. But if you train people, start their businesses, providing those in a community for every pair that you sell, right, you that helps you reach one more person, and you're creating jobs in the process. So that got me super excited. I moved down to El Salvador to work on the pilot program. And then started to sort of grow this nonprofit program to about 40 other countries. Wow. And that was sort of my introduction to the optical industry and sort of the power of glasses.
It's pretty amazing.
It is, like serendipitous, really,
yeah.
Right?
I met this Chinese guy once, God, James Chen, who showed up, and he had this pair of glasses. He had spent like $30 million developing. He could twist the knobs to get your prescription. I still own them. I have them. They were free. But he never, it was very difficult because I tried to brainstorm with him to figure out how to do something on scale, to get it to work, to deliver. And so anyways, yeah. You started yeah. there.
It was, I had a chance to meet James and see that technology. It was super interesting, right? And sort of magical that you could turn knobs and you could adjust a prescription. The challenge was that they didn't look that great.
No. They're probably on my desk, and you literally look like the computer who wore tennis shoes.
That's the thing. You could have, like, a great product, and if it don't look cool, it's like, nope.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you, I'd be in rural Bangladesh, and I can tell you that, you know, somebody living in a village in rural Bangladesh, living on, you know, less than $4 a day, cares as much about their own dignity and how they look and present themselves in their community as somebody right on Madison Avenue. So this nonprofit that I was running called Vision Spring, we had a saying, and that is that vanity is not monopolized by the rich. And it was really important that, right, we cater to the populations we were serving. And that's, you know, how do you provide them something that functions like a pair of glasses, but also how do you design for them so it looks good? Frankly, we had different assortments depending on where in the country we were serving, wow. right? Like there's different style in Central America than there is in West Africa than there is in South Asia.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, right, the social enterprises, the nonprofits, for-profit companies, those that succeed, right, treat folks as value-conscious consumers and respond to their needs and wants.
Wow. So that experience with Vision Spring really formed your ideas around Warby, but it wasn't the same company, right? You took a break and went to business school in the middle of that? Is
yeah.
that right?
Ended up going to business school. One of the things that I found with sort of working in the nonprofit sector, even though what I was doing I thought was like super impressive and super challenging, right? Setting up these operations all over the world and right serving folks living on less than $4 a day. Like, I got to tell you, it's much easier to sell something right in the U.S. than it is to somebody living on less than $4 a day. But I felt like I didn't have enough credibility because for whatever reason, right, folks don't always sort of value the work in the nonprofit sector as they do sort of the for-profit. So I thought going to business school, getting a credential, especially from a place like Wharton, like would, you know, put me on, you know, an accelerated sort of path. And it did because I met super smart people. And that's where we came up with the idea for Warby Parker.
Okay.
I was going to say, was that string or that kind of vision through, no pun intended, though, from Vision Spring to Warby always in your mind? Or did it kind of come out of another spot?
It really came out of a conversation in the halls of school. I mean, I thought that I might be a career switcher. I frankly ended up getting an offer to go to McKinsey. So I had a backup plan, but I didn't necessarily go into school with a sort of business plan in place. In fact, it was a conversation with Dave and Andy, two of my co-founders, and Jeff, our other co-founder, that, you know, was the genesis of the idea. You know, Dave had just broken a pair of glasses desperately needed a new pair. Dave had left a pair of $800 glasses in the seat pocket of an airplane. He had been traveling before school, and now, as a graduate student, wasn't about to spend that. Andy sort of posited the question, like, why isn't anybody selling glasses online? Because we had seen all these other categories move online. So, you know, this was a time period when Blue Nile was getting a lot of attention for selling engagement rings online. Mm-hmm. And people thought, like, you couldn't sell diamond rings online. Similarly, Zappos was selling sneakers online. And people thought, like, you couldn't buy sneakers online. And again, we take this all for granted now. But back then, that was super novel. So we thought, you know, somebody is, you know, probably going to make a lot of money selling glasses online. Why can't it be us? And similarly, right, I had some background in the space. And when I was at Vision Spring, I would travel to China and I would go to the factories. And here I would be manufacturing glasses for people living on less than $4 a day. But 10 feet away on the same production lines, I'd see some of the biggest names in fashion coming up. And, you know,
same glasses,
Marc Jacobs. Yeah. And it was like, this makes no sense. Why are these things so expensive? Mm-hmm. And we thought that we could design the frames we love, do the same quality, sell for a fraction of the price, and like create a brand that hopefully would resonate with
folks. Let me ask
one
question. Because one of the things that has resonated with me when I meet you and your partners is you guys have a whole lot of fun. Matter of fact, you might be the only guys that throw more parties than I throw, and I throw a lot of parties. And so you've got this group that you built this with, that you were friends with, that you throw giant parties with. You have few of your buddies have also started their own companies. And so talk a little bit about that culture of friendship / you know, partnership / network.
You know, for whatever reason, I think the four of us learned very quickly that, like, you only live once, and you need to spend time and work with people that you really respect and that you enjoy spending time with. And we heard that from a lot of people we deeply respect. So that has been, I think, ingrained in our psyche. But the other thing that we recognized early on was that building a business is super difficult and super challenging and can be very stressful. And when we speak to a lot of entrepreneurs, like those founding teams, right, you often hear that story of like founders, you know, having success and then quickly becoming enemies. So we actually were very deliberate in those early days, like thought about this, and we decided, you know, we're going to commit to each other to be friends throughout this process. And then we thought, okay, how do we ensure that happens? How do we make sure that we don't have like blowout fights or what have you? And we literally in business school every week, we would go to our favorite bar. It's a place called Roosevelt's. We'd sit at a table. We'd each have a beer. And we'd go around the table and say, you know, we'd give each other feedback. And we'd have a discussion. And we would make sure that small things didn't turn into really big things. And, you know, I would turn to a co-founder. And I remember this conversation with Jeff. And I say, dude, you just sent me a 10-page email last night at 2 in the morning about, like, our marketing plan. And this was something that I had been working on, and we agreed that I was going to focus on that. I was like, dude, I've been thinking about everything that you wrote. I wanted to, like, reach through the computer screen and strangle you. And he was like, Neil, like, I was just up and I was thinking about the business. I wanted to get these ideas down on paper. I didn't think you weren't doing these things. I just thought it might be helpful if I sent you a bunch of these thoughts. And sure enough, it is super helpful. And I was assuming the worst. And right, those little things, right, you discuss them, they make you better partners as opposed to sort of sweeping them under the rug and having them, you know, turn into something bigger. So I think we were very deliberate in trying to, you know, make sure that we were sort of friends throughout the process. And we were also really fortunate that, like, we really respect each other and learn from each other. And so Dave and I ended up sort of running the business once we graduated school. Jeff has gone on to start Harry's, the razor business, and now they've...
I could use one right now. Yeah.
They've launched a bunch of brands under Harry's. Andy has gone on to start Elephant Partners, a super successful venture fund with a couple $1 billion under management. So what's great is that we also continue to learn from each other as we have sort of like intersecting.
And whose ideas was the parties? Because I've been the benefactor or the... I've been the
beneficiary
of a few. I snuck into a couple, got invited to a couple, but great.
The unintended beneficiary.
But, well, listen, there's not that many people. I'm turning 60 soon. I'm have a big 60th that take parties seriously, that want to create an environment for people that's really exciting. Yeah. Most people throw shitty parties. Yeah. Yeah. They're not that many groups that were like, whoa, it's really exciting to go to their parties.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your parties are fun.
You know, at business school, it was in business school where we really got to know each other and become close friends. There's lots of theme parties. I think we all came to school with an appreciation of theme parties, but it certainly was nurtured and developed. And like, what constitutes a good party? It's the same thing that constitutes often a good team. Is that you want people that don't take themselves too seriously, that want to have fun, smile and have a good time. You know, at Warby, right, one of our core values is really around inject fun and quirkiness into everything that we do. And we talk about how, our success is based on having a super engaged team. A super engaged team is a combination of productivity and happiness. And in order to do that, right, we need to be helping each other sort of have fun. So some more dynamics.
You guys officially started the business like 2015, right?
2010.
2010. How long was the planning before?
You're only off by 5 years.
Yeah. How long was the planning before? Like, how much years did it take to actually plan, launch, get everything together before you open for business?
So we started working on the business winter 2008, and then launched it in February 2010. So about a year and a half. And we spent a lot of time sort of understanding the market, understanding the competitive landscape, the dynamics, where we want to sort of position ourselves. How do we have a premium product but price it at a fraction of the price? Then once we had like the fancy PowerPoint and the strategy set, it was really like, what are the three things that we needed to sort of prove out that this could work? And it was really, we needed product to sell, we needed a place to sell it, a website, and then we needed to promote it. We needed to let people know that we existed. So we really only invested cash into those three things: our first collection, building our website, and then hiring a PR firm to help us launch, because we knew we were selling a fashion accessory. Yes, glasses are a health product, but it's a fashion accessory. Like, you got to play the fashion game. The fashion game is, you know, fashion PR. It's at the time, right? What's the best men's fashion book? GQ. What's the best women's fashion book? Vogue. So those were our goals. How do we get into sort of Vogue and GQ? And we literally would call call everybody we knew to try and get introductions and connections to the right people. And we ended up having these desk sides, which are right what you call like a meeting with an editor or a writer, and would walk them through our lookbook, our collection, talk about sort of the ethos of the brand. And the fashion director at GQ was excited about it, said that she was gonna, you know, put us in the March issue. Similarly, Vogue agreed to do a story. So, like, we felt like that was gonna—
That was all year one?
That was year one. That was how we were gonna launch. Now, of course, just as tell you how naive we were. You know, we had been being told, oh, you're going to be in the March issue of GQ. We thought that we were going to launch, do a soft launch in like Thanksgiving. And the thought was like, if a bunch of our classmates, you know, bought our glasses, they would then go home for Thanksgiving, tell all their friends about it, and like we'd get some like organic sort of like viral marketing. Of course, it always takes twice as long and it's twice as expensive than you think. The business is not ready to launch in November. It's not ready to launch in December, January. We still don't have a live website. We get a call from the fashion director at GQ, is like, hey guys, like, you know, this is the first week of February. She's like, you guys got to get the website up. Like, what's going on here? And we're like, oh, don't worry. Like, we'll have the website up by March 1st. You don't have anything to worry. And she was like, guys, the March issue comes out in February. Like, you got to get, like, this thing out. So we launched the website February 15th. Friends start calling. We didn't tell any of our friends because we didn't know if it was going to work, if there were bugs. Friends start calling like, hey, your website's live. And we're like, oh, yes. Would you mind just clicking through it and telling us, like, if there's any, like, bugs or anything?
Yeah.
And from there, the company just took off like a rocket ship. We hit our first year's sales targets in 3 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles in 4 weeks, had a wait list of thousands of people. It was wild.
Yeah. So you guys didn't have a moment where you felt like, oh, the business might fail?
We certainly had our doubts going in, but it was sort of one of those stories where it just took off. I mean, we had to make some quick decisions because we basically stopped going to class because we had to process orders, respond to customer emails and calls all day. We launched with this home try-on program where people could select 5 frames. We ship it to them free of cost. And if there was a pair they like at that point, right, they put in their prescription lenses and we send it to them. We start to run out of inventory, like literally within 48 hours of the try-on program. So Jeff, Dave, Andy, and I are sort of in my kitchen talking about what we should do, and we're debating it. And Dave had set his phone to get a notification every time we got an order. And his phone's like, while we're discussing this, his phone's like buzzing. And finally he's like, guys, like, you realize in the last like 4 minutes as we've been discussing this, I've gotten like 10 order, like, we got to shut this thing down. So we had to call our developer. We didn't even have sold out functionality built for the website. I had to like figure that out. Cause we didn't want to start taking a bunch of orders that we wouldn't be able to fulfill and have a bunch of angry customers. But
that's amazing. It's so impressive how deliberate you were with this strategy. And what I wanted to ask is, you had been in El Salvador or India, places like that, talking about $4 glasses. And then you were also talking about $800 glasses, $10,000 glasses or whatever. How did you look at pricing? And what's interesting, I hear you saying, like, you really paid attention to the fashion aspect of it, not just the kind of functionality of it in a sense, right? And you said that even when you were in El Salvador, people still at $4 cared. How did you look at pricing? You could have priced $20, you could have priced $200. You know, I know you were trying to disrupt the market, but what was that about? Or what was that deliberation like?
Yeah, so like we would go into the market, and a lot of the frames that we liked were typically like $400 to $500, and those were often sort of like the premium brands, but like also just like good design. So we thought, oh, we're gonna come in and price it at a tenth of the price, $45, and you know, the beauty of like working on a business plan in business school was that we could go ask our friends who were marketing experts or former consultants or had worked in fashion. But we could also go to professors as well. And the head of the marketing department at Wharton was a pricing expert. So we go into his office. We have this like beautiful presentation. And we say, hey, we're going to transform the optical industry. We're going to charge $45 for glasses that would typically cost $400 or $500. And we're going to, you know, do this online. And before we even finish, he cuts us off and he's like, this is not going to work. And like, what are you talking about? Like, you haven't even looked at our presentation. Like, first of all, like, look, every single graph goes up and to the right. And he's like, listen, pricing something at 1/10 the price is just outside the realm of believability. Like, price is the biggest indicator of quality. And no one's going to believe this is a quality product. And, you know, we kind of walked out of there pretty deflated. An entrepreneurial journey is like just a roller coaster of emotions, but it forced us to go back and rethink. And we ended up sort of whenever we sort of faced an obstacle like that, we would think, okay, how can we sort of cheaply get sort of some more information to help us make a good decision? So we used SurveyMonkey and created a survey that we sent to about a couple hundred people, mostly friends and friends of friends, and we mocked up what would be the product page on our website that had a pair of glasses on it. And we had like five different versions of this, each with a different price on it, from like $45 up to several hundred dollars. And we sort of created randomized samples of these, you know, a couple hundred people, sent it out, and we just asked them a simple question: how likely are you to purchase this pair of glasses? Some people got the $45, some people got $95, some people got, you know, $200. And we found that the willingness to purchase increased with price up until about $100 and then came down.
Wow.
So we realized, oh, yeah, price does matter, and people actually are more likely to buy if it's a little more expensive, but this $100 is like a barrier. So then this is where sort of like the art and science comes in. We could have priced it at $99, right? That would have like maximized based on the data. But then we thought $99 sounded like cheap. It sounded like a dollar store. And again, we were creating this like premium brand. So we decided to price it at $95. So, like, visually, it kind of looked better. It seemed more deliberate. And we think that that was a like really sort of critical decision that helped us be successful.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, the $20 glasses, you actually just literally lose because you don't care about them.
Yeah.
The $100 glasses, you're pissed off when you lose.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too, being in, you know, approaching it as a fashion brand. We all know it's like part of it is just like what that says about you, and if it's like what says about you is like I paid $20 for my glasses, like you know, you pay $5 for your glasses, but that's because you're not worried about what it's, you know, says about you, except when you want to. Sometimes you are, sometimes you're
so
not.
So, question for us, because again, I went from tons of $5 glasses, which. Really, it just was a disaster to a lot of Warby's, which have been great. My wife, for a Christmas present, got me a appointment to go to this glasses store in Paris. It's the most expensive sunglasses store on the planet, or glasses store on the planet. And when I went in there, I was like, well, what's their shtick? And the guy looks at you, and the first thing he says, your pupils are very close together. I was like, oh, no. Felt like the guy from Beetlejuice, you know. And, you know, his view was, well, if your pupils look close, we need to fool them to be symmetrical, to look good. And to be fair, he had a great shtick. And so this part of the glass might be longer for you. And so he's helping you fit these bizarrely expensive glasses. And, you know, they're gorgeous, to be fair. They're gorgeous, and they have all kinds of different kind of frames. But there was a real salesmanship to what glasses look good on me. Right. And how did you learn that? Or did you learn that? Is it part of your – do you teach your salesman when Dave walks in to say, hey, you got kind of a round head, therefore you need – this kind of glasses, or a skinny head, you need these kind of glasses.
Definitely. Well, we tell people one thing to look at is what's called your pupillary distance, right? How close your eyes are together. We tell them not to tell somebody that, like, your eyes are too close together.
Is like, Mike's eyes too close?
But it definitely informs, right, some of their recommendations. But it was also that insight in the early days of the business planning phase when we would ask people, you know, would you buy glasses online? Overwhelmingly, people said, no way. Like, how am I supposed to know if they look good or not? And in general, we are all terrible glasses shoppers, right? We do it pretty infrequently. Americans buy glasses every 2 to 2.5 years. Typically, it's a very guided experience. You walk into an optical shop, and frankly, to help justify the high price, like the glasses are in a glass display or behind the counter out of reach. And, you know, the person sort of pretends to do magic to fit you for it. So you don't even have, even the once every 2 to 2.5 years that you're going, you don't even have practice because the guy is sort of doing it for you. So that gave us a lot of pause about even starting the business. And that's where the idea for the home try-on came from. We could send you 5 pairs of glasses, try it on at home, and then you could get feedback from your friends or your spouse. And that was a big unlock. And now, yeah, that we have stores, right, because we didn't launch with stores, but now we have, you know, 240-plus stores, is, yeah, how do we get sort of super dynamic folks that have a sense of style but also understand the nuances of prescriptions and how frames fit to give you confidence that, like, hey, these are a great pair of glasses for you.
Do you guys still consider yourself a DTC, direct-to-consumer company, or has the stores changed your kind of shape and outlook on that? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. DTC in the last, I feel like, 2 years maybe have become a four-letter word for a lot of folks, and that was just as customer acquisition costs increased. We've sort of always viewed ourselves as we're a lifestyle brand. We're a tech-enabled lifestyle brand, meaning that we leverage technology to create awesome customer experiences. We don't necessarily care how we sell glasses as long as it's what the customer wants and it's easy for them. Mm-hmm. We've always believed that if we have direct relationships with our customers, either through somebody buying on our website or on one of our apps or in our stores, right, we're going to ensure that's an awesome experience. It also enables us to cut out the middleman, make sure we're, you know, providing lower prices because we're vertically integrated. So, yeah, I would categorize us as direct consumer because we design our own product, we manufacture our own product, and we sell direct to our customers in our stores or online.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I question, we always ask this. You grew up on Mercer, went to Friends, which is a
expensive. My kids went to Friends. They started at Friends.
So did you grow up a rich kid?
I would say upper middle class.
New York. That's New York rich. I mean, that's globally rich. It's New York middle class.
Yeah.
It's globally rich, and certainly U.S. rich.
I mean, I definitely.
He also grew up like 3 blocks, maybe, I don't know, less than a quarter mile away from Electric Lady Studios, where Jimi Hendrix laid down all his tracks, and so like. It's a cool fucking neighborhood, right?
Particularly at that time.
Where was that studio again? Is that the studio
on 8th Street?
On 8th. Yeah.
I tried to buy that at one point.
Yeah, I remember.
Did not go well. Did not go well, but it's just a cool, you know, cool area.
What do you think about your rich upbringing? do you think that gave you the confidence to kind of go and shoot for the stars? You did a lot of nonprofit things. Even that takes some confidence, right? Because you're like, I'm not going to make money. It takes a lot of confidence. But if you're rich, right, you're like, look, I could fall back. Like, I started doing nonprofit things when I made some money and I was like, all right, I could pay for my bills. You know, before that, I just had to grind. Was it just like a passion, or you had the comfortability of like, look, I still got the apartment on Mercer, still went to a good school, I could kind of change careers if I want to. Did that add, growing up, however you grew up, rich, middle class, New York rich, did that give you the confidence to just go do anything and say, look, I could, if I don't succeed, I'm gonna be okay regardless of what, right? Because what with me, growing up very poor, I almost had to, and still feel like I have to succeed or like everyone in my family's kind of fucked. Swear jar. We have a swear jar here.
Definitely. I think there were sort of two dynamics. One was that even though I knew that I was wealthy and financially secure, I was typically around people that were wealthier. Yeah. So that I think instilled sort of a hunger, right? When you start to have friends that have really nice houses in the Hamptons, for example.
You're talking about my life? That's literally my life.
Right. And it's, right, you aspire to that. You know, what one of the things I did find that was interesting is that growing up in New York City versus like a suburb, in a suburb, you know the car that everybody drives. You go to people's houses and you see the differences in houses. There's a competition there that we didn't seem to have in downtown Manhattan in the 80s and 90s because you're getting around all the same. You're walking, you're taking the subway, you're in a taxi. Yes, some people had fancier sneakers than others.
Great but point, actually.
Yeah,
it wasn't as apparent, and the competition around wealth wasn't the same.
Where I grew up, we knew, like, Courtney Gasper's dad was an orthodontist, and damn, he was rich because he was the orthodontist. Like, you knew who the rich people were. There were, like, four of them in my middle-class neighborhood. But you knew by their house, you knew by their car, you knew by their dad's job.
Right.
And in New York, you have no idea.
That is a great point. Nobody ever pointed that out before. It is.
Now,
maybe take $20 out of the tip jar.
Now, there's no question that, right, my parents, right, provided me sort of financial security, that I was able to, right, go to college without student debt, that I was able to sort of work nonprofit, that I was able to take some unpaid internships that, right, I wouldn't have been able to otherwise. Also, being an only child, like, I also, there was additional sort of security there. I wonder if my wife would describe me as a mama's boy, but like I always felt like I could go back and live at home. Like I don't think that I've ever lived alone or actually like signed a lease because I was always like either living at home or roommates. Living with like a girlfriend, wife. And
right. You know, it's funny because that does two things, right? There's some people, which I see more often than others, some people, because they have that security, right? They almost, they have the confidence in like, I can do that if I want to, and I'm going to do that. But they never actually do it because they kind of know. No, serious. I know a ton of people like that. I could name names, but.
That would be very nice.
No, I wouldn't do that. Right? I'm just saying I could, all right, but I wouldn't. But. That's what happens a lot, right? Like, I have this dream. I'm fully capable of doing it. I'm smart enough to do it. I'll get around to it. And they never get around to it because they never signed a lease. They, versus me or Mike, or Dave was also born rich. But Dave also had that drive to go and do it no matter what, right? And you had that drive to go and do it even though you didn't have to do it. So I tend to see that a lot of people who have the comfortability to not do it, right? They think about doing it. They have the smarts to do it. They have the everything, the financial backing. They just don't do it. And then every so often you meet yourself or Dave who didn't really have to do it. Just
and your point is that they have like magic dust on them?
Yeah, I think they is something.
Or maybe what is it? Maybe what is it? Yeah. Yeah, his experience. What is it? That pushed him through like, that.
I know what it is with Dave.
Gene?
So it has to be like a.
Well, we're asking.
Right? Yeah. Interrupting Jaw again.
Yeah, because I was going to like throw the flag on like that was a statement that became a question. You had four minutes to make it one question.
Sorry, we all worked for Mike here, by the way.
Well, I always look at Mike's family and be like, this is a case study and like super success because before I knew Mike, I knew his sister. and new sort of Acumen Fund. And Acumen Fund was a donor to Vision Spring, and was an investor in Vision Spring as we were sort of building Vision Spring as a nonprofit. But, you know, for me, I think, yeah, I was very much influenced. My parents are doers, and also care deeply for their friends and family, like most do. But, you know, I would see examples of my mom every day. If somebody got sick, she was the first one to go over, bring them food, care for them. She was the first one, if somebody was in the hospital, to go and sit with them in the hospital. Right? I think a lot of people probably have nurses in their lives, and like this is very typical of people that become nurses. I also think of like a very tangible experience. Again, the 80s and 90s in Greenwich Village wasn't exactly the same that it is now. Not that it was super dangerous, but I had a Little League game. It was on sort of Hudson Street, and there was a shootout. Mm-hmm. And my mom was sort of watching. I was up to bat, and my dad was like, I think, one of the coaches. Right, we had to all sort of, you know, get down on the ground as we heard gunshots and saw people running. And you know, before I could look up, my dad was running to go hail down a bus or find a payphone to call 911. This was before cell phones, and my mom was rushing to the area where people had just been shot while the person with the gun is like running on the same block. So that was pretty formative for me to see, like, you know, folks and the most sort of influential people in my life, my parents, sort of when it mattered, right, jumped into action to take care of folks. This one guy was shot 3 times. My mom helped stop the bleeding before the ambulance came.
Shout out to his mom.
Yeah. How old were you? How old were you at that time?
I think I was like 10, 11.
Wow.
So your mom ran into the fire and your dad ran off to, like, you know what, I'm going to go get some help. Like, this shit seemed crazy.
Funny, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. You know what I was going to say, what really impressed me also about
you just ruined Saturday dinner at the
is you know, this I don't want to call it altruism, but one of the, between working for a not-for-profit and then starting a for-profit company, I think you're the first person we've had on that you formed Warby as not a C corp, but a
public benefit corporation,
right? Which briefly means, like, if you're forming it as a C corporation, the only thing you can really focus on is shareholder value at that point in time. And this concept of a public benefit corporation, which I think was invented 10 years ago or something like that, if you elect to do that, then your shareholders know that in addition to their value, I believe that, like, employee satisfaction, community, things like this can be considered. So would you talk about that for a second?
Sure. The public benefit corporation is the legal status that enables the board of directors to balance the interests of your stakeholders. So in our case, that's shareholders, that's employees, that's our customers and the environment. And ultimately, we believe that by sort of thinking about our stakeholders, that's how you create the most sort of financial value and the most value for, mm-hmm. for shareholders, right? If we want happy customers that are going to spend a lot with us, we need to provide exceptional customer experiences. If you're going to provide exceptional customer experiences, you need super engaged team members. Mm-hmm. What motivates team members? Sort of the mission. Our mission is to provide vision for all. Mm-hmm. And probably the best example of how we do that is for every pair of glasses we sell, we distribute one to someone in need. And just last year, we passed a really big milestone. We've provided over 15 million pairs of glasses to people around the world, and including a bunch here in the U.S. You'd be shocked at how many kids in America don't have the glasses they need. Mm-hmm. And we're now operating.
I'm 100 of those.
Yeah. No, that's really cool because we talk a lot about corporate responsibility, right? To give back in a sense and to have the guts to really register your company as a public benefit corporation. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool. Not a lot of people do that. And it's
most
it's
people
really
don't know the Delaware
thinking.
Law says the board's sole responsibility is shareholder value.
Right.
Like they're not even supposed to be able to think of the other stakeholders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Again, that's, you know, there's some nuance there, but.
But effectively, but, that's correct.
But making the affirmative statement is saying, hey, we're going to care about more.
Right. Is bold.
Well, it's also, it's interesting though. So let's get to a more touchy issue because that movement, right, Just Capital, Paul Jones helped start this thing, Just Capital, which broadly said if companies operate like Warby, they're going to create more shareholder value. Mm-hmm. He has all kinds of graphs to show you that the companies that are the most just do the best. I can't think of anything wrong with that movement.
Right.
It kind of collided or ran sideways with this DEI movement let's make sure we have diverse workforces, that make sure we really are nice to the environment. Mm-hmm. And that's gotten a really bad, smell to it recently. There's an anti-DEI thing going. Maybe it got pushed too far. It's goes right up the heart of left versus right in America. And so how have you navigated this kind of backlash against DEI? And how do you even approach DEI at Warby?
Yeah, you know, I think we always just try and be data-driven, make sort of practical choices that are going to serve our shareholders. An example of that, again, is like our Buy a Pair, Give a Pair program. You know, how do we distribute glasses in a really thoughtful way to make sure that we're having the impact that we seek and that we're considering the second and third order effects? I think where there might be backlashes to certain ESG movements or DE&I movements, it's because, I think often folks are conflating a lot of things together,
right.
But also not necessarily always thinking through second, third order effects. So as an example, right, having worked a lot in international development and nonprofit world, right, you'd often see people with good intentions go to a low-income area and then just give away a bunch of free shit. Sorry, is that the swear?
No. Yeah.
We give our guests three swears. Yeah. After that, we're going to dock you.
Yeah, and free stuff. It makes sense in certain situations, certainly in like relief situations. You have a crisis and you need to get something, stabilize a situation, a population. When it's an emerging economy where, there's commerce happening, dumping a bunch of free goods is, right, the concept of dumping. And it lowers prices, it hurts existing vendors and sellers. So how do you make sure that good intentions have the impact that you want? So as an example, we're now the largest donor to the nonprofit Vision Spring I used to run. And again, the way they distribute glasses is by training local entrepreneurs to sell them at an affordable price. So that way you're creating jobs, you're creating the economic incentive to provide glasses. When we go into schools in the U.S., for example, we give the glasses away for free because that's the most effective way to get glasses on kids' faces to have the educational outcomes that we want. And we do it in schools because that's the easiest place to reach the kids. And what we do is we actually design collections and give agencies to the students to select the frame that they want. Because again, if it doesn't look good, the kid's not gonna wear it, we're not gonna have the impact that we want. Then we partner with an academic institution. We partnered with Johns Hopkins. We did a 3-year longitudinal study of our program in Baltimore. And we found that a pair of glasses is the equivalent of 3 months of additional schooling.
Wow.
And if the child has special needs, it's the equivalent of 6 months.
Wow.
There's not another educational intervention, not extending the school day, not private tutoring, not computers in classrooms that has that sort of impact. So why did I go and do that academic study? Not because I needed to be assured that this has impact, but it's, now I have data and I can go to all these different municipalities and say, hey, work with us on this. You know, you guys cover the doctors, we'll cover the glasses. So everyone has skin in the game and we're going to solve the these issues. And now we're in 40 cities across the U.S. Providing glasses. But I think that's how we tend to approach it, is just methodically and thoughtfully.
How, changing up a little, how's being public? You guys went public like a year and a half ago, is that right? So, you know, I've always been involved with private companies. Mike's had the fortune or misfortune twice of public companies. How has that changed how you look at it? You know, not so much as good move, bad move, but just, you know, you enjoy it more, less.
How does it change the parties?
It's definitely been a different experience and a learning one. You know, when a company takes outside capital, they make an explicit commitment to getting liquidity for those investors at some point. And right, that's either through a sale or going public. So we recognized that we were going to go public. I'm not sure that I would recommend going public at the top of the market like we did in September 2021. And it was awesome for those first few months. And then, right, the public markets corrected. And it's been a tough go for a lot of growth companies and small and mid-cap businesses where sort of we live. But at the end of the day, we know that if we perform, good things will happen to the stock.
Yeah. Do you think a lot about how to keep the daily stock fluctuations out of your mind, out of the morale of your employees? How do you handle that?
I try to deliberately provide context to what's going on in the capital markets in a way that helps folks understand, but also not spend too much time, right? I don't want, you know, our teams focused on the share price every single day, but I want them to understand the frameworks by how folks think about share price, right? That goes back to valuation, and that is tied to a DCF model. And the more that we sell, the more money that we make, and how that compounds over time is, you know, how you create value. So being public, I think, has helped us have more of those conversations internally. And I need to always be making sure that I'm connecting sort of value creation on an enterprise level to individual teams. And that's what I think all good management teams do. So, you know, we just had earnings. One of the other things that we do is for sort of like director and above, right, we'll have like a Q&A. We'll spend a little more time on, you know, explaining what happened, what we think happened with the stock, how meetings are going with sell side analysts, with the buy side. And people find it pretty interesting.
So you alluded to this earlier. A lot of the direct to consumer brands, we're getting paid for growth. We're getting paid for growth. It didn't matter if it was a fintech company or a consumer company. And the mistake they made was, we'll spend, you know, $90 to get Mel to be a customer to buy a $60 thing, because we think he'll be a repeat customer. Was that your biggest mistake since starting Warby? Did you make that same mistake, and how have you adjusted to that? Or did you not make that mistake and the stock just went down because?
You know, we thankfully avoided that mistake. One of the things that we were very disciplined on from day one was, we're only going to spend up to sort of like first transaction profitability. So we'll spend up to our sort of gross profit dollars on that first order, because especially as a new company, you don't know when that person's going to come back. You don't know how much you might need to spend to re-engage them. So in the early days of Warby, we always wanted to be very conservative. And to your point, right, all of these companies that were flush with cash because of low interest rates and the venture markets being on fire, were assuming that their customers were worth way more than they were. They were going out 10 years, and it's like, okay, so we can spend this much to acquire them. You know, at the same time, sort of Facebook And sort of the social channels became very effective at charging rents, customer acquisition, and just driving up their VIGs on that. I mean, when we launched, it was before Facebook had monetized, before they acquired Instagram, right? And it was a beautiful time to start a business and acquire customers because there was such thing as organic growth, and things went viral without having to pay for it. And right over time, right, these networks have charged larger and larger VIGs on it. So I think one of the things that we could have done better was just driving overall profitability faster. Like, our gross margins were always healthy, our customer acquisitions costs were always healthy, but we were also building an expense base based on, you know, 20 plus percent growth,
right?
Right. The pandemic hits, then you have to quickly jump into action, sort of think about your expense base. How quickly is this going to be an issue? Right. We were always well capitalized to make sure that we could sort of go through a storm. You know, when we were one of the sort of first national chains to close our stores, it was effectively us and Apple on March 13th in 2020, and we continued to pay our employees in those store teams, again, because we thought it was the right thing to do. But we had, it wasn't a difficult decision because we were well capitalized and in a good state to do that. And we also structured it in a way where it's like, hey, we thought that the government might come in, and we said, hey, until the government comes in, right, or we'll guarantee for this time period. And thankfully, the government did step up at one point. But
how do you, everyone's talking about AI these days. You used to talk about 3D printing. I haven't heard as much about that, but it seems like it would apply to glasses a little bit. Mel just got his Apple Vision.
Vision.
Talk about technology.
Yeah.
So good.
How much do you pay attention to AI, 3D printing? Where's technology shaping your business?
Huge impact. You know, we've been working on AI-related projects for basically since we started the business. You know, the funny thing is that as soon as an area of AI becomes widely used, then we just come up with a different name for it, like machine learning. But we were the first to launch a true-to-scale virtual try-on, and that involves AI algorithms around fit, because that's a real challenge. It's very different than, you know, putting, like, you know, pretend makeup on, for example, because you can just identify anything in an image and make it a different color. It's another thing to take a third-party object and make sure that it's true to scale on someone's face. But we had to identify pupillary distance. We had to identify nose bridges, figure out exactly where to position the frame, and again, make it the right scale. So that's an example. We have a virtual vision test where you can renew your prescription remotely. So again, we've been using a lot of these tools, different prescription transcription, where we're able to use language models to sort of read a prescription and, you know, automate it in our systems. So within our category, I would argue that we're sort of the technology leader.
So if you whatever vision you have with AI for the future, do you see that cutting your workforce?
I see it unleashing a ton of productivity. So, you know, each one of our team members, you know, will be able to accomplish eventually like 2 to 3 10x more. You know, while I thought a lot of the talk about the metaverse and some other technological trends were a little BS-y, I think most people would agree this AI thing is real. And we're on the verge of another industrial revolution. And that's really exciting. And it will create new jobs, it will transform jobs, but ultimately it'll just make every human on the planet that much more productive and successful.
Fun questions. What age did you make your first $1 million?
On paper or in real life?
Probably real.
I guess probably 30-ish.
Wow, you beat Mike. You're beating Mike at everything. The parties.
He's got good parties. He's got good hair.
Good hair. Shit.
Let's go. This is what public is. It makes you gray.
or bald.
What was your biggest purchase?
Or most inspirational? Like when you said, I've worked really hard. I've made some money. I got to do something. Buy my mom something. Buy my girlfriend. Buy myself something. Like... Where money actually changed how you'd behave.
Yeah.
We ask everybody this, don't panic.
Yeah. I think of a few different things. One was buying a watch, and it was an IWC. And of course, I haven't worn watches now in probably 10 plus years, but that was like a big. Sort of purchase.
Mel, do you know an IWC?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
IWC.
No, I don't know that.
You don't know them?
No.
IWC?
Mel's our watch guy.
Yeah, they're big. They were really big when Panerai was big and like 10
years
ago.
How much
were they?
Yeah.
20 grand, probably 15 grand.
Did they grow in value or just stayed there?
They're those big ones. You've seen them. IWC, Schaffenhausen, or something. I don't know, some other German word after it. Mm-hmm. I think they're Swiss.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I have them somewhere, but I thought it was appreciating in value.
He thinks it's worth more.
I think so. An automatic. Obviously, no quartz, no battery driven. And then ultimately it was like, what's a dream of every New Yorker? It's to own your own apartment. So that was big.
That's cool. All right, if you had a superpower, what would it be? Like a Marvel superpower.
You mean what I currently have or what would I want?
Wait, you have a fucking superpower?
I don't know. I feel like all
vision,
business
vision.
Interviews, it's like, what's your superpower?
No, like Mike wanted to be Thor.
Just because I wanted the hair.
I would want to freeze time. Yeah, if you could freeze, like, what's the one thing we all want more of?
Yeah.
Is time. Mm-hmm. And, like, you could freeze time, do a bunch of the annoying stuff that you wouldn't want to do, and then unfreeze it, and then, hang out with your friends and do.
What do you do when you're not working? Like, so for me, I watch TV. Shogun, if you guys haven't seen Shogun,
is it good?
Awesome new miniseries.
Yeah. Someone else was talking about
Tokyo Vice.
Tokyo Vice, awesome. The one with Dior and... Chanel. Oh, other than you probably never buy Chanel for your wife again once you see this thing.
Really?
Yeah, Coco was, at least the way they're portraying her, you're not a big Coco fan and you're a huge Dior fan. Wow. So I do TV. That's how I chill. What's your chill?
I probably walk. I walk a lot in the city.
It's much healthier chill.
But definitely TV. Sometimes I'll actually... If I have uninterrupted time, both my kids are young, so I have less of that, but I'll turn on even cable TV. Mm-hmm. And then I don't have to choose something, because otherwise I'm spending, like everybody else, like half an hour, an hour, and I only have that much time to choose something. If I put on cable, there'll be some, Nick Cage movie.
Yeah.
And
that's funny. Basic cable, right there. Shout out to Basic
amazing.
Cable.
And then I'll sometimes, if it's a great afternoon, I'll fall asleep. And it'll be the best afternoon ever.
What's what's exciting you about Warby in the next 5 years, the industry, what you want to do with it, kind of where's your head, focused on that?
Yeah, I'm excited about just scale. One of our other core values is scale with integrity. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a lot easier to create cool brands using scarcity. So like you could have all these like niche cool brands, but if you want to have impact, you need scale. So we've 240 plus stores now. I'm excited to get to 1,000.
Are you in Dubai and those kind of places yet, or are you just mostly U.S.?
Just U.S. focus. We were advised early on, strategy is what you say no to. And the U.S. market is disproportionately large for the optical industry. About a third of the global market is here.
Wow.
And that's not because we need more glasses. Yeah.
U.S.A.
But it's like, we got so, there are 45,000 optical shops in the U.S. Like, we got a long runway here. So when
45,000 and you're 200.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Like we're going to bring him on in 2 more years. And if he's not 1,000, I'm going to headbutt him.
But I what I want is when people say, what are your favorite brands? And people say, Nike, Apple, Warby Parker. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully we'll be having sort of impact on culture and society, right, beyond saving people money on glasses, making them feel good and smart.
So we started this podcast literally because me, Dave, and Mel used to go out to dinner a lot. And Mel would say, dudes, you know, if you grew up in my neighborhood, you don't get insight into finance, into entrepreneurship, into markets, and you don't get network. And so, and then we met a few of Mel's friends and become good friends with Dave and I, and they were like, man, every time we invite Larry Morrow to a party, he comes up from New Orleans. And it was like, well, because he wanted us to be part of that circle. And so we thought, let's do this podcast, really directed originally at the underserved community of would-be entrepreneurs out there that don't get to hear from you. That was the shtick. We've had a lot of fun doing it. We had a lot of debate over the name. Business Untitled was Mel's idea.
Or Mike and Friends was his idea.
Just somebody Mike. Wait, was it Mike and Friends or just Mike?
Just Mike.
And so we never thought about sponsorship, but you know, all of a sudden we have a little shtick at the end of each episode, which Dave, for the first 22 episodes, provided the gold. But we ask each person for an ounce of gold, and we literally had J&M Bullion, who is the flagship store of A-Mark Precious Metals. They are an S&P 500 company, one of the biggest direct-to-consumer gold companies, and they're now giving us our gold. So we have our first sponsor, shout out, J&M Bullion. We shouted about last week, but I'm excited because we never thought about doing this for finance. We thought about doing it for fun and for some social good, and now we've got a sponsor that at least covers Dave's gold. we're not going to ask you for the Warby's yet, but it's not a bad idea. You give Warby's for all our guests. So your ounce of gold, because this is your gold.
Give it to him.
Oh, awesome.
You got to keep that.
Thank you.
You end up giving out the ounce of gold.
I'm the J.M. Bullion contact. I'm the gold macro guy. Gold is up today 3%. It's on its way. Gold is going to chase Bitcoin. It's going to be 3,000 by the end of the year, or I'm going to have to headbutt the wall. It's 2,000 right now, but most people don't have an ounce of gold to keep in their pocket as good luck.
And so we basically ask, like, what's your ounce of gold, your ounce of wisdom, so to speak, that...
You've given us a lot. But
yeah, like a lot.
One kernel you want to leave the audience with.
I think it would be always take the first step, right? You got to be proactive in anything that you do. And I don't know anybody that's been successful that's been passive, right? The people that are successful, they just do. Mm-hmm. They go in and do. They see a problem. They don't complain. They might complain about it, but they come up with a solution, and they don't just talk about the solution. They're taking the steps towards it. So if you're working in an office and you're the CEO is 10 layers above you, or you're the CEO, it's still the same approach. Be proactive. Anticipate what is needed and go and do it before you're asked.
Warby Parker, just do it.
Oh, proactivity.
Oh shit, that's Nike. Warby Parker,
be proactive.
That's a good ounce of gold.
All right,
it was great.
Thanks a ton.
Yeah, Neil, thank you very much.
Wait, awesome. I want to give the big announcement.
Okay. Do it.
Big announcement, people. We now have our second sponsorship, Warby Parker. Contact him. He's going to work it all out.
JK.
At least I get a pair of glasses once a year. Yeah.
But thank you.
Thanks a ton.
Yeah, thanks a ton. Awesome. It was great.
Thank you, guys.
Here we are. We're live. We're back. We're back in the podcast because I didn't realize, but Mel, because he loves me so much, got me 3 pairs of Warby. He's going to have Neil fit me these things so I actually don't look like this or like this or like this.
Or one side missing.
Right. What do you think, Neil?
I think this will look good. Maybe just pull a little slightly forward.
Is his eyes close together?
Maybe a little farther
maybe
back.
Back it up.
Yeah, there we go.
Perfect.
Yeah. I got a little bump on my nose there.
That looks good.
Right here, people.
There you go.
Blue Steve.
All right, we got to try on some more.
That's one pair. What's the second? Oh, these are close to what I usually wear.
Oh my God, you look like a superhero.
Oh yeah.
Where's the hair? Somebody bring the hair.
All right, pair three.
I'm not so sure about these.
Oh, I'm gonna look like Clark Kent. If he had hair, he was bald.
A little Moby. A little Moby.
Yeah. Oh, no, not Moby.
Give us Studio 54 vibes.
All right, which is your vote, Mel?
I like number one.
Dave?
I like one, but two, I might vote two.
I'll go number one, but I think the ones that you have.
Number one right there. For the day.
You need a leather jacket for number one in you.
I'll be a fighter pilot again. All right, guys, Business Untitled checking out. Thank you.
Thank you.